Huzzah, and welcome to the Knights of the Hardcover, a podcast dedicated to discussing fantasy books, their lore, and all of the things that we love about them. My name is Brandon Castle, you're a Roga of the West Coast, and joining me on this path to the end of the world, he looks seven, but he's actually 30,000 years old, it's Chris Lauer.
Hey guys, nothing clever to say today, just want to mention how grateful I am to be here with you guys.
Aw, that's nice.
Loser. All right, and also, he's always asking me if he can eat my stone-turned arms. It's Zach Mysick.
Nice.
Yeah, I do have to say, if I have to bail you guys out one more time, I think I will fully turn into stone.
Nice.
Bail us out of what? What are we talking here?
Yeah.
What are you bailing us out of?
I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Boredom. You're bailing us out of boredom. You guys are like the only two people I ever text, by the way. I was looking at my phone the other day, like the texts from the last like 6 months, and I was like,
yeah,
I don't really talk to anyone these days, so thank you for being my friend.
Yeah. You know, in my texts on my phone, I have like three bubbles at the top of my phone. If you have an iPhone, you probably know what I mean in your messages app. It's our group chat, my wife, and a local radio station that I like to text into. Those are my top three.
What are you texting into the local radio station? Yeah.
You know, this sports thoughts and whatnot, things about what they're saying.
Okay, folks, we'll get to the book here in a second because I still haven't introduced that. Chris, I'm going to need you to pull up your phone and read the last text that you sent into this radio station.
Oh, I don't know. It's been a while.
Let me look. This podcast is no longer about fantasy books. We're just going to go through Chris's phone.
Yeah.
Do they respond?
Sometimes they do, yeah. They'll respond over the radio. They'll be like, Chris texts in, he says this, you know, and then maybe they'll talk about it. That's the juice. That's what you're looking for.
How many times?
The back and forth.
How many times have they read your text on there?
I have a decent hit rate for when I like, you know, it's probably close to like 5 to 10%, something like that. But sometimes when I feel like I really have a good one, I know they're going to touch on it when it's like, when it's a good one, but
all right.
Yeah.
My dad, he had a blog a lot about Nebraska football, and he had like the Lincoln Journal Star pick up on it once. And he talked about that for years. They quoted him in the newspaper once, and he will never let us forget it.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, today, back to the fantasy books. Today we're covering the 2016 second novel of the Broken Earth trilogy, The Obelisk Gate by N.K. Jemisin. Now, you probably listened to the first podcast if you're listening to this one. We're going to cover this full trilogy because I think we all really liked these books, and so we're going to do the full trilogy. Usually we just do kind of like the first installment of the books, but this one deserves, I think, the full trilogy to be hit on, so... Before we get into that, though, how's your guys' New Year's? Happy New Year.
Oh, thanks. It was a nice New Year. We had some people over to our place. One of the guests was a tiny baby. Our friend brought their young infant, and so it was a good time.
Did he get drunk?
The baby?
Yeah.
Oh, slosh. Didn't take much. Nice. Just about one shot. It was really cool. All the baby kid needed. Oh, yeah. Very chill.
Zach, what'd you do? Did you go over? You went over to Chris's too, right?
Yeah, I was the baby.
Oh, you.
Oh, he's on a heater today.
Yeah.
All right. Chris or Zach's firing all cylinders. We're good. Yeah.
How's yours?
We didn't like do anything because we were going to go to the Winter Classic the next day. So we kind of just like went to dinner and then just hung out here. But I like saw your guys' B-reels, and Aaron and I both got real sad. We're both just like, we're sitting here doing nothing, and all our friends are hanging out together. Winter Classic ended up being worth it. That was a lot of fun. So
yeah.
Cool.
Should have zoomed in.
Yeah, well, I would have been there in a heartbeat. It would have been pretty late for you guys, I guess. But
that's true.
Did we ever come up with a name for our summary? We'll figure that out. Something about a tome. I don't know. We'll workshop that one. But we're going to start off here with a summary. Chris, if you want to take us away, let's do it.
Yeah. The story picks up with Aesun remaining in Kestrema with Alabaster. Alabaster is dying and is trying to teach Aesun as much as he can about the obelisk before his body turns to stone. Renara Renaris, a rival Comm, tries to take Kestrema by force. While the Comms discuss their acceptance of Orogenes in their town, Aesun almost destroys the whole Comm out of anger, but Alavaster stops her with his final action before fully becoming stone. She successfully uses Alabaster's training to tap the power of all the obelisks worldwide to form the Obelisk Gate. She uses this power to turn everyone in Renaris to stone. However, this is not enough to fully save Kestrema, and they begin preparations to leave. The story also follows Aesun's daughter, Nasun. Nasun was taken by her father south to try to cure her of her orogeny. They eventually get to their new home of Found Moon, a shelter for young orogenies led by Shafa. Nasun and Shafa form a strong bond while Nasun learns more about Orogeny. Nasun learns how to call an obelisk to her and accidentally uses her power to kill a classmate. As her abilities grow, her dad realizes she is not being cured and attempts to kill Nasun, forcing her to use her powers to turn her father to stone. Nasun and Aesun both want to bring back the moon, but for different motivations. That's where our book leaves off.
Oh my gosh, that was so much nicer than having to listen through like 10 minutes of that. Good work, Zach, with shortening up our summaries. Thank you so much.
That's not a short summary. Yeah. It's good.
Yeah, that's what we've been needed. That's what this podcast needed. So, well, good. This was an interesting book. Let's just get right into our ratings reviews here. So we're going to try out something new this week. Chris, do you want to introduce that?
Yeah, so it's just kind of a new rating scale. Instead of doing like a 1 through 10, we're going to rate it based on hardcover editions, essentially. So we're the Knights of the Hardcover. So we're kind of going to say, you know, what would your rating be? It's a hardcover is like to say I would get this book in a hardcover. So instead of saying the numbers, we're going to kind of put it in, make it a little more themed here.
Yeah, so the scale goes all the way from tweet to a signed edition. So if we would only read this book if it was on Twitter in tweet version, which would be awful, that would be the lowest rating. Signed copy, highest rating. You know what? I'm just going to read through all of them just so that we have like that established within the pod. So it's going to be tweet, fanfic, or Wattpad, which I just learned about today, blog, newsletter, ebook, paperback, hardcover, limited edition, leather bound, and then signed. So that will be our rating. If you can't remember that, just think about how expensive the book would be if you were to buy it on Amazon based on those.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's intuitive. You know, if you say, you know, I like this book so much, I'm going to get a limited edition. You know, I think you kind of know like, oh, that's you must have really liked it. You know, it's about an 8. So I think it makes sense.
I think it makes sense too. Although very rarely am I buying a special edition book. But anyways, that's besides the point. All right. So Zach, you want to start us off with your book ranking for this?
Yes, I will. I love this book. I think I liked it slightly less than the first book. If I had to like, use the scale, I think the first book for me would be a signed limited edition leather bound or whatever the highest one is. And I think this one's just one below it, maybe even two. I think it'd be like a hard cover, and you maybe could talk me into buying like the leather bound for it, but for sure a hard cover for this. I thought it really built on the ideas of the first book, and it used those relationships with Alabaster, it used their past like with their kids, and it really like built that with the relationship with her daughter. You can kind of see how she acts and like why she mothered the way that she mothered. And you can kind of see the daughter's point of view of why she reacts a certain way because of how she was mothered. So I loved everything about the book, but I think I liked it slightly less than the first one.
Yeah. I like what you say about the relationship, like how you can really see, like, I loved that, you know, we hated Shafa for like a lot of the things that he did to Aesun in the first book. And then in the second book, you see Nasun be like, well, you know, my mom broke my hand too, you know, and you're like, oh my God, in that moment, like you would never get that from Aesun's POV. You get it from Nasun's POV and you believe it. You're like, but I can't believe she did it. And I really love how they do that in the book, but you're right. It wasn't as good as the first one for me either. So it was just like one tier below the first one, and I'll probably go hardcover on this one. I think at times I would knock it a bit because at times I do think I was a little bored, and it really had a sophomore slump kind of feeling to me. It was like, okay, I know where we're going is going to be really good, and this is the work we have to do to get there, but it is a little bit of the work we have to do to get there kind of a deal. So that's where I'd land.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that, Chris. It is interesting because whenever you have to go backwards in time to catch up a story, so like what they had to do with Nathan's story, we had to kind of like see everything from their perspective. I really like that. We were just so in one place in both of the story or all three of the POVs. So we were just in the calm or we were just in Found Moon the entire time. And so where the first one, we were traveling throughout the country and you were getting like a lot of world building through it. Now we were kind of situated in these spots and really just learning more about the things that the first book set up, and which is good. All that is good things, because I think this is like kind of a natural progression of a trilogy. It's like you build the world, you dive deep into that world, and then you come to like an ultimate conclusion and show what the world can really do in the last book. And so I don't think it's a knock at all to say I didn't like this one as much as the first one. I didn't expect to like this one as much as the first one, but it was still close. Like, I still really enjoyed reading the book. I got a little bored with the calm stuff in the middle of them, like, oh, we're not going to have enough food. And it's like, okay, well, figure that out. I don't know. So I would also go with a hardcover. I think I did like a limited edition on the first book, but I'd do a hardcover on this, which is kind of contradictory because I just bought the three in paperback, but you know, whatever. I would buy them in hardcover.
Yeah, yeah, in a perfect world.
Yeah, the box set's just too good of a deal. What are you going to do? It's not my fault. All right. So let's talk through some of the essential plot points. I think we're going to do these broken out by POV. So we'll start with Aesyn, then Dushafa, and then Nasun. Zach, you want to lead us through this?
Yeah, I mean, with her, we did kind of like pick up right where we left her, which is kind of nice. Her and Alabaster and talking about trying to get the moon back. And kind of throughout this book with Aesyn, it kind of mimics the first book where Alabaster would just kind of slowly feed her information and she gets kind of frustrated with it. I guess we learned about the obelisk gate through them, about those floating obelisks. If you connect them all, you can kind of do... You can, I guess, create magic and do magic that way. And then through this part two, you do get some more like Stone Eater lore, which I thought was interesting. But I guess I liked the setup where you got that teacher mentor back, because that's kind of what I missed from that first book. So I was happy to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every Alabaster Aesyn conversation is like riveting. It's really, really... I wish we would have had more of it in this, because ultimately Alabaster was only able to talk for like 30 minutes at a time. And so we just got kind of small snippets every now and then. But he gave us a little Sander Lanch there at the beginning, kind of describing everything that happened with him after the pirate ship expedition happened.
Yeah.
And we learn about like a new character of the Earth being kind of its own character and being like a sentient being in that conversation, which was fascinating. We learned why he opened the rift, which was to like give power to everyone to pull back the moon, or give them the Earth's power, I guess, essentially. So that whole conversation at the beginning here was incredible.
Yeah, he's definitely got like the crazy madman with the crazy idea, but actually he has everything kind of figured out vibes, which he works really well in this book. I loved what was going on with him the whole time, where it's like, you know, he's dying over here. He's literally getting eaten by the Stone Eater and you don't know why, but it's like, you just kind of have to accept that it's happening and hope that you can learn as much as you can. So the Alabaster stuff was really good in this book, as always. Good, great character, really.
Yeah. Yeah. That city sounds cool, where they dragged him to. It's just like a city of Stone Eaters.
Yeah.
It's in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Like on the other side of the world or wherever. Like that was, I thought that was really cool.
This, if they ever adapt this to a movie or something, they need to have a huge budget to make this successful, because like that has to look really cool. They can't just low budget that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know if I want to see like the stone eaters eating alabaster like that. Anytime that would happen, of it's like gnawing on like his like, elbow. It's like, ugh.
What was that movie from our childhood with the rock eater in it? Was that Little Dinosaurs or something like that?
Oh man, I don't know.
I can't.
There's a rock man that basically just ate rocks all the time, and it grossed me out so bad as a kid because the noise was just the worst. Anyways, besides the point. Okay, and then they also talk a bit about guardians in that conversation too, and just talk about like that those implants like connect them to the earth and things like that. So we get a little bit more backstory about like why the guardians have power and what they can do with that power as well. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, the guardians I'm very interested in. I'm excited. That's one of the things I'm most excited for in the next book is to really figure out all their secrets.
It's got some real like ruin from Mistborn vibes to it, where they're all like have like the sliver in it, and they're being controlled by ruin, you know, subtly, which is interesting. But now we have a bunch of broken guardians, so who knows what that means?
Yeah,
probably not good.
Yeah,
yeah. I feel like during this stuff, you guys finally got your answer. Because I think in our last conversation, you guys found it was like a coincidence that what's Essun's companion?
Hoa?
No.
Oh, Tonki.
Yeah. How she was there during school and how she's here like in the comp and how that was kind of convenient. We finally got like that reveal of how they've been like tracking her this whole time.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. She'd been like following her around.
Yeah.
Tonki's a weird character.
Yeah.
Do we know what her motivation is yet? Is it just to learn about this all, or just do we know like why she wants to learn it?
I don't know if we fully know why. I think she's given us some answers, but I don't know if it's like her actual answers or not. Because I think it's just like learn, and she kind of has her own little group of rich friends who are trying to learn.
Yeah,
learn more out of weirdo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in that conversation, we also learned about like the name of the book, Obelisk Gate. Alabaster kind of explains the connect all of the obelisks together at the Obelisk Gate to use as a giant power to bring the moon back into orbit. Which, wow, that was. I don't know if that's physically possible, but you know, whatever, magic, I guess.
yeah well, like, that's almost kind of like almost a criticism I have for the book a little bit, is the magic part of it, because there wasn't a lot of magic discussion in the first book, and it kind of becomes a big thing here in the second book, where there's orogeny and then there's this other thing called magic. And I'm not like giving up hope or anything. I'm sure this third book can maybe answer some of my questions, but it does kind of seem like, oh, just throw in magic when you had this like really developed and really precise magic system. And then you're like, oh, but actually there's this other one, and it's just, we're going to call it magic, and it's unexplainable. And I don't really love that. So I hope it nails down a little bit more on the magic part of this to see what we get there.
I just wish they would have called it something else. You know, I don't mind that they introduced it, but just calling it magic seemed a little like cheeky almost or something. And it just was kind of like, didn't really hit great for me, but
yeah. More to discover there, I hope.
Hopefully. Yeah. Then yeah. So Alabaster, our good friend, turns to stone fully. We've been seeing.
Yeah.
Whatever her name is, chomping on his arms for days now, and he saves the calm by stopping Essun from killing them all, which was wild. She turned pretty quick there. She's like, yeah, I could probably just kill everyone. All right, I'll just do that. Yeah.
For real though, she's quick to kill sometimes.
Yeah.
She's liable to lose her mind a little bit.
Yeah, but I guess that seems like pretty on par with the rest of the origins. So you kind of get that much power, you lose your mind a little bit. Just look at like Alabaster. Mm-hmm. Not exactly a full bag of marbles there. So
mm-hmm. No, I really like that, those scenes. I know like the comp stuff was probably like my least favorite. Like it did kind of get kind of boring. But I did get like some dread where it's like, yeah, you are just like stuck down there. And when they'd send like scouts up above just to like hear what the land looks like and how dangerous it is. And then it's like, do you meet with these other comps that are out there? And then they get attacked by other comps. Like, I thought the book did a good job of like how much like dread and how much like it would suck and there's no hope. So it was cool to see Esun kind of just almost snap her fingers and kind of get rid of like the biggest problem that they have.
Yeah.
Chris, do you like that when in a book they, you know, they're trying to show that like they've been here for a long time or that they're really trapped or whatever. So they draw these parts out for a long time to kind of make the reader feel that as well. Do you think that's like effective? Or I guess it's two questions. Do you think it's effective? And do you like that it's effective?
I honestly don't know if I have a good answer to that. It really just depends on how I feel when I'm reading it. It's kind of a cop-out answer, but when I'm reading it, does it feel like a slog? Is that if you're telling me that that's the point for the author is to make it feel like a slog to me, I'm not sure if, I don't know if I love it. I think you could show the passage of time in more ways than just, man, I'm really going to grind things to a halt so that you realize how long this is like in time or whatever. I don't know. But if you do it well, you know, and I don't think this book did it bad either, you know?
Yeah. It was just a little bit much, but yes, I definitely agree with you, Zach. I felt it. I was like, ugh, I would hate being trapped down there. And then food starts running out. Oh boy.
Yeah. People slowly get crazy. People kind of turn on the people who have those origin powers. She gets roped into like teaching people. Like I liked it. I wasn't the strongest part of the book, but I can't remember a time where an example like you just mentioned, like I can't imagine an example where I enjoyed it more than like her kind of showing how much time has passed and for you to really sit in it and see how these people are kind of going stir crazy. And so I enjoyed it.
That's one thing I did really like about this part where I'm forgetting the name of the leader of this con. Do you guys remember the name? What her name is?
Oh, hold on. I have it. Lerna? No. Say your point and I'll get it here in a second.
Yeah, well, whoever that is, I really liked in this book how she was... At the beginning of the book, obviously, she's so adamant that her comm would never turn against the origins, you know, and that's a huge theme of this book is Esun saying, look, this is the way it is. They turn on us. I'm sorry, it's going to happen, you know, and then the leader of the comm just like not accepting it. And then, it all kind of comes to a head here at the end. And I really liked I liked that friction in the book.
There was a couple of frictions like that I really like. I liked the friction between the Stone Eaters. I liked the friction between, you know, leader and her council and the comm as a whole was really good. The origins between the comm was really good. Like all of the conflict in this book was more subtle, I think, than maybe the first one. In some ways, I guess. But it was really effective and it was good for character development, especially, which is what conflict should do. So,
yeah.
I can't remember her name. I don't think I wrote it down. So she wasn't that important.
So did you guys like the way that this second comm was like introduced and brought in as a bit of an antagonist? Did kind of the way that it was brought up, did that work? Do you guys like that? Did it work for you?
Do you mean like, what exactly do you mean it being like an antagonist?
Well, like just how there's this other comm and they're going to come take over this comm.
Oh, that one, Renarius or whatever.
Yep. And they have their own Stone Eaters or whatever. Like just, did you guys like that conflict?
Zach?
I did. I enjoyed it because I mean, that's kind of because in the first book, when you kind of learn more about the seasons, how it works, you do learn that the stronger comms may attack the weaker comms or the calmless may attack some of the other comms. And they've always hinted at like, we are just kind of sitting here like underground ready for another shake or ready for just to, like be attacked or like waited out. So I did think that there's enough foreshadowing I did like how it wasn't just like humans attacking, that it was Stone Eaters and people with powers were in it too. And it did kind of add that dread where it's like everyone in that comm is already going crazy down underground. And then you have this other threat who's just kind of going to wait them out or go in for an assault. So it worked for me. It wasn't, again, wasn't the plot point that I was the most focused on, but I enjoyed it. And I kind of felt that dread of like, okay, how are you going to get out of it? And I thought it was a worthy enough thing for like Alabaster and Essun to like show their power and to make those like sacrifices to save the comp. And they didn't just like save the comp, like the comp's fucked, you know? So it wasn't like they just beat the big baddie of the book and then it's on to book three. It's like there's some big ramifications from it. But I don't know. Did it work for you?
Chris or me? Who are you talking to?
Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. Okay. It felt a little sudden to me. While I was still like processing that there was another comm out there that could be even on the same level as them, it was a little bit jarring for me to then also process the fact that this comm is like easily more powerful. But in general, I liked everything you said there, Zach. Really, I mean, you just talking about it made me appreciate it more than I might have before.
Yeah,
I kind of feel like it was inevitable. You know, like when they introduced the comm in the first book, I thought it was inevitable that there'd be something like that would happen. Someone would kind of come try to take it over. Because otherwise, like, they're just going to stay in the comm and try to, you know, build up food stores. Like, there had to be a reason to get them out somehow. So I think that was probably the most effective way possible. Do you guys want to talk about the Tonki stuff at all? Her, like, figuring out how the comm works, or is there anything to like really say there? I just thought that scene was weird. I don't know. I don't like a convenient character, and Tonki, we don't talk about her like at all in the book, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, and then Tonki figured out everything, and then it's like back to the comm. It's like, all right,
yeah, well,
Tonki's really smart, I guess.
Yeah, if I want to like be very generous, it's just, you know, that character's kind of going crazy, it just kind of show it. But it was kind of, I don't want to say like lazy writing, but it was kind of like, okay, you needed to explain some things, and this is like a way to do it. It's just to have your character break into it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's just skip over that then. All right, let's get to the kind of the climax of Essun's story, which is when the comm's all ready for the attack, and then Rhenaeus attacks, and or I guess first we have the Stone Eater show up with Hoa's arm, which was kind of awesome actually. And like Hoa like hanging like half out of the ground, like half dead, trying to save himself. I'm really, really starting to buy into the Essun like Hoa relationship. It was kind of weird in the first one when you think he's like a 7-year-old, but now that you understand him a little bit more, it makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah. It was a super badass scene when that other Stone Eater showed up and he's like, I fucking killed that guy. You thought he was gonna stop me? No.
Yeah,
he's done. Even though he wasn't done, but still.
yeah, plenty more to go still.
Yeah.
And then Hoa ultimately comes back to life, correct? He like resurrects from that egg as his old self, which we saw in the first book. So it's like his actual Stone Eater form now, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting, his longing to be a human again. Like, he, like, missed, like, his little human aspects of himself. I think the evolution of these Stone Eaters, like, the more we learn about them and more, like, we learn about their desires and everything has been really interesting part of it.
Yeah, I have, I guess, maybe it's a theory, maybe it's not, but we can obviously save that for later. Do you guys have anything else you want to touch on for Essun before we do a quick hitter on Shaffa?
I guess super quick, her weaponizing those beetle bugs and even sacrificing some of her own people. That was like,
yeah, that was cool.
That was like badass. And just, yeah, just being like, sorry, bros, you're sealed in there too with it, you know? And you get that other chapter of how shitty those boil bugs or whatever, boil beetles, like how bad
they were.
So that was cool. And then she ends up in that coma, and this will kind of lead into like our next character, but one of my favorite chapters was a Hoa chapter POV where he's talking to people, and it was like he stood there for maybe days, but probably not. It was probably like 2 minutes, and like, you know, he was talking for years, you know, maybe not, maybe it was just, you know, 2 seconds. So it's really a cool POV.
Yeah.
From Hoa.
Yeah. Well, I know, I agree. What you're talking about, that POV where he's like, well, it seemed like it took forever, but I guess it could have been like, you know, a couple minutes. I really don't have a good perception of time. It was just so interesting. And you mentioned it, how it leads into Shaffa's first chapter where he was reborn. It's one of my favorite chapters I read in any book all year. I absolutely loved the way that that was written. And I thought it was just so affecting. And you really, like, it's such an abstract concept. Like, what was happening to that character is so abstract. Like, I don't even know if I could explain it to you talking to you guys right now. But when you read it in that chapter, it makes complete sense. And I think there was some line in there where it says that everything that was Shaffa was taken out of Shaffa. And I just thought that, like, I don't know, just like it made complete sense, but there's no way I could like re-describe like what it meant. So it's just extremely well written. I absolutely was delighted by that chapter.
I was a bit confused about that though, when they're like, everything that was Shaffa was taken from Shaffa. And then we start to see him have like memories of being Shaffa later. So was it not all taken from him, or was that just like his willpower overcoming like the earth effect, like the voice in his head that was changing him? Like I don't know. I was just confused by that.
I don't know. I don't think it's supposed to be necessarily like perfectly drawn out, but I kind of like almost a take it how you will type of a line almost.
Okay. That makes sense. I guess we should probably finish up Aesyn's real quick though, because they have the whole battle and everything like that, and then she connects to all the obelisks and wins the battle.
Sure, yeah.
Just to wrap that up. Moving on to Shaffa now. I just wanted to put a tie a bow on that section. move on to Shaffa. So the rebirth. We didn't get before we even get into the actual plot points, we didn't get much Shaffa. Like, it's just transitions. We get a couple POVs from him, and then it just transitions to Nathan telling the story after that. Do you think that was like a deliberate choice by the author to show like those first couple chapters were still Shaffa, and then he's fully broken after that, and then so they just, he doesn't get a POV because there is no Shaffa anymore? Or do you think that was just like, it was a better storytelling to have it be Nathan who tells the story?
Probably like a mix of both. I mean, I like that you get those two Shaffa chapters of, it's like, is this still Shaffa? Is it not? We'll find out. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. It's like, we have no idea what happened during his rebirth, who's in control. Mm-hmm. And then you just leave it like that. And then you set him free next to Nathun. And I like that, because you never knew what was kind of going on in his mind after that initial couple chapters. So I think it was intentional. Like, it really worked for me. I wouldn't have wanted more Shaffa POVs, because I think it would have like diluted that mystery of like, who's in control of Shaffa.
Yeah, I agree. Because especially right after I read the chapter, I thought, oh my gosh, everything that was like, the first thing I thought was when it said everything that was Shaffa was taken away, is I thought, oh my gosh, everything that was caring and loving about Shaffa is now gone. But then you spend all this time with Nathun with him, and it seems like he's more caring, more loving. He's no longer willing to break a hand to teach a lesson. You know, his motivations seem completely different. So then I started thinking, okay, so everything that made Shaffa was taken away from him, maybe that was some of the bad stuff, and all of the good things are still there, or maybe he has some ulterior motives, you know? So I also love that you just get that one little piece of it, and then all you have left is his actions, and you really don't know what his motivations still are. Can't wait to find out what they are in the next book, though, for sure.
That was really well said. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree with both of you. We didn't need any more Shaffa. The point of a POV character is to like get inside their head, and like there wasn't a lot inside of his head. Just like, really, at that point, it was more like, go away, Earth. That was about all that was going on in his head. So, Father Earth, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. That first Shaffa chapter had like probably one of my favorite lines of the series. And I don't have the direct quote, but when he was just like thinking to himself, like, how could Nathun kill her son? Like, how could he, like, why would she do that? Like, when I was going to take him, like, she knows I would have been so gentle with him. I would have laid him down in that cradle so gently. And that was just like, it gave me chills. Cause you know, like, we know what that means. Like, we've seen what that means. It's just like so fucked up, and it's fucked up that Shaffa thinks that he's Like he's he's baffled. Yeah, he's like,
yeah,
he's baffled by it. And then you understand the weight of like Essun's decision and Alabaster's like reaction to it. One of my favorite lines of the whole book, whole series.
That's the best part about these characters. And we talked about this a lot in the first pod, but how the character development is incredible, but they're all like very nuanced too. There's no real like good or bad in this book. It's real, you know, like even Nasun, who's like, you know, an innocent child, but she's an idiot, but also like justified in being an idiot. And like, it's just very, it's very real. And I love that.
Yeah. So. That's exactly right, Brandon. It really, these characters feel like they're real people. Like they're fully fleshed. You know, Essun is our main character. I sympathize with Essun. I love Essun, but I can't believe she, you know, broke her daughter's hand. But I also, then you get Asun's perspectives and she's like, I had to do it. I felt like this was the only way. This is the only way I knew. And you're like, well, it is the only way, you know, it's like, it's not good, but this is all terrible. But you really empathize with these people. And that's not easy to do. That's top tier character development here.
Yeah.
I don't think I empathize with Shaffa so much anymore. I don't know. Not a lot of empathy for that guy, but everyone else I get.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess though he was turned into that as a child. So like also, yes, there is empathy for him because he had no choice. There's no decision for him. He tried to get away from it, but they made him a guardian anyways.
Well, and new Shaffa. I didn't really empathize with old Shaffa as much, but new Shaffa, now I don't know exactly what new Shaffa is, but he seems like a caring, we just don't know what his intention is, you know?
A little too caring, if you ask me.
Yeah,
I don't know. I get the bad. Oh, it's just creepy vibes every time him and Nasun or him and young Essun were like talking together. It's just like, ew.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I hear you. Yeah.
Is this the Catholic Church or what? Just kidding. Okay, just kidding. That was bad. I didn't mean it. sorry.
This would be a good time before we get to Nasun. Maybe this would be a good time to think, like, you know, what is Shaffa doing here with these kids? Like, what is he trying to do? What do you think, Brandon? Because Zach might know, but what do you think, Brandon?
Well, so I think we kind of know from this book, right? Like, Shaffa is a pawn of Father Earth. Father Earth lost the moon because of what Origins did previously by sending it away. And so he wants to just get the moon back because that's his child. And so he's using these pawns to train like complicit origins so that they can bring back the moon for Father Earth. I think that's the kind of the understanding I got from this.
Gotcha.
Like it's all just a ploy by Father Earth to use to position pieces to get the moon back so that he can have the power, I assume, that comes with the moon. I assume the moon has a lot of power of some sort or whatever. Like a giant obelisk is what I'm kind of imagining it is. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think I
envy your conviction on this because I really spend most of my time thinking about like Shaffa's motivation. Like I don't know what anybody wants. I don't know what Hoa wants. I don't know what the Stone Eaters from that other comm want. I know they didn't seem to be on the same side, but I don't know what side either of them are on. I don't know who's controlling Shaffa. Like the Guardians are still such a mystery because when the Guardians were the Guardians before Alabaster broke the world, they had something in their head that is suppressing something. And if whatever is being suppressed is no longer suppressed, those guardians would then kill each other. So what was the guardians' motivations as an organization before the breaking? And now that the breaking has happened and Shaffa has lost, he's basically lost his battle to whatever is trying to control him. Is that Earth or were they working for Earth before? You know, I really don't know. I'm just completely confused about what all these characters' motivations are, except for obviously Essun and Nasun.
I guess that's a good point. Like the Guardians still have agency before they fully like break. So what's their skin in this game? Like what is their
goal? Why are they trying to hold back the Origins?
I mean, it might just be kind of like a cult type thing where they've just generation after generation been taught that once you get this power, you just have to stop Origins or control Origins. So maybe it's just like a learned behavior type thing. But that seems too convenient as well.
Yeah. But that's all I got. Zach, you could probably give us a lot of color on this, but we will find out when we get to the next book.
Before we go to Nasty, let's just talk real quick about him starting Found Moon then. So he comes and like finds his first recruit. Very similar story to Aesun, whatever her name was at the time when he found her, Daima. And he finds this kid and this is basically his first recruit for the new Fulcrum. Is that what it was called? Fulcrum?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, okay. So new Fulcrum basically just runs it the same way, but without like as militant of a strategy, a little bit more leniency maybe. And basically puts all eggs into the Nathan bucket and everyone else can kind of fuck off. did you guys, I don't know. What was just your general thoughts? I don't really have any question about that. Just what were your general thoughts about Found Moon?
I was afraid because his first recruit, it was like mimicking Esun's recruitments, except for the fact that Shafa like murdered his entire family. And he's kind of like, oops, like I just like murdered everyone.
Yeah.
Oh, can I say goodbye to it? Can I say goodbye to my parents? And he's like, it's best not to.
No.
Yeah. So it's like
best to just leave him.
Yeah. So it's like that. I thought that was really cool because we got a recruitment in the first book that was really lovely and sweet. Mm-hmm. But then he ended up being like really mean to Esun, or like tough love, to put it kindly.
Yeah.
With her training. And then it's kind of the opposite so far with Nasun, where it's like he started off like murdering a recruit's family.
Yeah.
And then now he's just like very gentle with Nasun.
Yeah.
So just very kind of confusing of what's going on.
He's just all over the fucking place. He's just like a psychopath and then he's like a nice dude and he's back to a psychopath. Yeah. It's just crazy.
Are you rooted like when he's in that pain and he's like smiling, kind of smiling through the pain? Are you wanting Nasun to like pull on those silver threads to ease the pain, or are you like stay the fuck away, don't touch
anything? Stay the fuck away, do not touch those silver threads. I don't know why though.
Nothing good can come from it. I have to imagine touching those threads has to be a terrible thing. So I don't know.
Yeah, I was split. A part of me was kind of like, just you know, ease his pain a little bit, but also too, I'm just like stay away from him. I don't know. I was kind of like,
yeah,
I was kind of torn.
I don't know. I kind of liked him being in pain. I'm gonna be honest. It was kind of nice. He's inflicted a lot of pain to other people, so I was like, you know, just let him feel it a little bit.
Well, you know, that's another question. Why is it if he's now finally given in to something that's been trying to control him? Why is it that now he's in so much pain?
I am guessing that it's because like the transformation that's happening is painful. That's what I thought. But it also could be the resistance to the change that's painful. I don't know.
Yeah.
A lot of unknowns with Shafa still.
Yeah.
All right, Zach, tell us. Give us a spoiler.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is tough because, I mean, that kind of stuff is interesting. Some of that, like, legit answers. But kind of what we've been kind of talking about is, for me, that stuff I don't really focus on. I focus more on like these character developments, the relationships, learning why they do certain things. That's why this is like one of my favorite fantasy books, is because of like the motivations and the character developments. The actual like lore stuff of like, what is a stone eater and why is an arm turning into stone and why are they eating it and what are like obelisks and what is the obelisk gate? It's like, and why do you need the moon? Like that stuff is cool to an extent, but like that's not why I turn to this point. Like I don't give a fuck about the moon. What I care about is kind of, you have this mother-daughter relationship with the moon now, and they have like a similar goal. And to me, it doesn't matter what the goal is, just the fact that they're both kind of on the same path. And we've so some of these like questions
very differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what's like interesting about this book is like, yeah, you know, you do get answers to things, but for me, I'm like, I just kind of, I care about it, but like that's not why I read it.
I gotta know. I'm not good, especially like this book in particular. I'm terrible. Usually when we read these books, I can at least predict a couple things that are going to happen. I can't predict shit in this book. Like everything that the only thing I even got like remotely right was someone was going to attack the Kestremacom. Like I just thought that was going to happen at some point. Everything else I've been dead fucking wrong about. So
yeah,
I need
that's
to know.
That's very exciting. That's
it's exciting, great. You know? It keeps me reading, keeps me turning the pages. So. All right, let's hit on Nasoon now for a little bit. So we start off, we go all the way back to the beginning, basically, to when her dad, Jija, he, terrible name. he kills her brother to start things off because he finds out that he's an origin and then takes her away. And we see, like, the push and pull of them traveling together, of like him wanting to hate her but then seeing his daughter again and loving her, and then she'll do a little bit of origin and I'll be like, fuck, I hate this bitch, and then I'll be like, oh, but I love her so much, and it's just going back and forth. Gotta be real traumatizing for like an 8-year-old or whatever she is right now. Yeah, that's gotta be tough to deal with.
Yeah, and you could tell it is really tough to deal with, and you can feel it in the writing. You know, it feels tough to deal with. You can see how it affects her and her decision making, and where she finds comfort. You know, in Shafa, a parental figure willing to give her some semblance of love. Another great POV chapter. The first chapter you get with Nasoon of the immediate aftermath of the death of her brother by her dad. Really, really liked how that worked out. And in general, something I really like from Nasoon is her manipulation of her father. That was just really well done. Very interesting to read.
She's so smart. I mean, that like emotional intelligence that she has, like knowing her dad so well for whatever she is, maybe I think she's like 10, but just being able to like identify those things and then manipulate them is really cool to see in like a young female character, is really interesting.
Yep.
So yeah, she saves them on the road. Found Moon. So they find Found Moon. That's the ultimate goal. This scene was really cool. I really, really liked when they first find it, and then like the bandits come get them and like stab him in the leg with that hook, and she uses like the slicing method of origin. So cool. I love a new introduction of magic, but this was so different than the way that Aesun uses magic. It's just, or origin, I guess. It was just really cool to see that just right off the bat.
Yeah. I think all that stuff's interesting with how you can use origin. Like, you have like the Fulcrum trained people, you have that comp that Aesun's at that are just kind of like those wildlings who kind of have their own brand of using origin, and then now you have Nasoon who has her own kind of flavor of how to use origin. It's kind of really cool how they all have their twists on it, and kind of why the Fulcrum chooses to only teach certain things and why not.
Do we know why like some origins are more powerful than others, or is it just like birth?
I think it's like birth
type thing.
I think it's like birth. So. That's why they do like those like breeding programs and stuff. I think it is kind of based off birth.
And do we know, was Aesun's parents? No, they were not. We saw that in the first scene of the first book. Yeah, they weren't. Okay, interesting. So it's sort of like a offshoot of like a chosen one type story, but it's not exactly that. Like, she can communicate with obelisks. I guess that's kind of like the chosen one aspect of it, but.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, it's who's the chosen one? Aesun or Nasoon, you know? It could be either one, could be both of them together.
I can't wait to do some predictions with you, Chris. This is going to be like shooting from the hip for sure.
Yeah.
I go back, I like make a prediction, and then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, that's stupid. What are you doing? So yeah, you made a good point though of the dad being such a weirdo, kind of drives Nasoon into Shafa's arms, and they kind of have that father daughter relationship, similar to what Aesun has with him. Don't love it. Did not. gross to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it felt weird. He treats young children strangely. I don't know. Shop is a weird dude. I get that he's manipulating. Makes me uncomfortable. I don't know.
Yeah. I get it from Nasun's point of view, and I think the book does a really good job showing kind of how messed up she is. And when you read the way like her dad acts with her, you know, you just think to yourself, like, oh my gosh, why are you even around your dad? Like, go find your mom. Like, she knows her mom is kind of looking for her, or she can sense it at points. And you're just like, go find your mom. But then you get those little like peek behind the curtains of just how fucked up her mom was, like raising her.
Yep.
And then you're like, oh shit. Like, okay, now I understand why you pivoted to the third option of Shafa. It's because you have a fucked up mom and a fucked up dad. And even like the fucked up mom raising her, it's like you could understand why she had to raise her that way, is because she knew that Nasun was super powerful and she had to make sure that she could handle her emotions. Otherwise, she would cause, you know, big shakes. And you saw the way that she was messed up from her upbringing and her trauma and her just placing it all on Nasun. This is like a really, really good job of just taking everything that you've learned about all the characters in the first book and kind of just like funneling it all to Nasun. It's like everything in like the first book is condensed it, and you made that first book a character. Yeah. You made the first book like a character, and that's like Nasun. And I just, I loved everything kind of about her setup. And I was just so afraid when she kind of linked up with Shafa, and I was like so nervous. I'm like, is Shafa going to like connect the dots between Essun and Nasun?
Yeah.
That was just really, really intense of, will he figure it out? And if so, like, how is he going to react to that?
So Zach, you're saying that Nasun is like, so you guys know the concept of ki, or maybe I'm doing this wrong, where you can, like martial arts, you put all your energy into like a small point or whatever and push it out. Oh. So
centering Nasun your body
is basically the author is centering all the trauma into one character, aka Nasun, and then the third book, they're gonna push it all out in one big force.
I hope so.
Yeah.
God damn, I hope so.
I mean, it definitely seems like Nasun is getting a lot of like people's like trauma dumps, you know.
Oh yeah.
The way that she's been raised and everything like put on her.
I wouldn't call her stable at this point.
One thing I thought was, I kept thinking about this throughout the book, was like, why the fuck did Essun have multiple kids who she knew were probably going to be Origenes with a guy that wasn't and was clearly adamantly against Origenes? Why, like, she couldn't have found anyone else to have more. I know that like she had to kill her son, so she wanted to replace him with more kids and stuff. I get that. But I feel like there would have been a better person than Jija to do this with.
Yeah.
I almost think that was like the point, is because like she had to go into like such deep hiding that you would never like look there. But
and maybe, I'm not sure she necessarily knew how much Jija hated. I mean, she as far as much as if you ask her, everybody hates Origins. You know, if they're not an Origin, they all hate Origins. So she's just like, Yeah, so he hates Origins, so what? So does everybody. You know, she doesn't necessarily know that he hates it so much that he would, you know, kill his son in anger still, you know.
I mean, at that point, just like, don't have kids. Like, if you need to be in hiding that badly, just like, don't do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
It probably would have been safer. Probably still be in hiding at this point, but whatever.
Yeah.
So then we have Nasun who is having like a massive nightmare. One of her classmates and sort of friends comes up and tries to wake her up. She turns him into a fucking stone. Real rude. Not a nice wake up. But I sleepwalk too, so I get it. When I sleepwalk, I eat peanuts. Found that out recently. Aaron's caught me sleepwalking twice to go get some peanuts.
Wow. That's funny.
But anyway, she turns someone into stone. It's her first murder and doesn't sit well with her. Don't have a lot to say about this, but this was a pretty intense scene. Like, you could really feel the emotion here.
It was pretty sad. Definitely makes sense. Like, if the goal is to show that she's kind of losing her marbles, this was a great step in that direction.
Yeah.
Yes. Which ultimately leads into her Antarctic visit, where her and Shafa go visit the Antarctic fulcrum.
Yeah, and so Shafa just fully against everything that he used to be for, but we don't know what he was for then and what he is for now.
So maybe
it's definitely not what he was in, what he wanted to do before.
Maybe it is. Who knows? We don't know. Right, we certainly don't. Anyways, Nathan killed 22 students.
Yeah, so she's like super powerful, super unhinged, and in the guidance of an absolute madman. So I'm sure things are going to go great for Nasoon in the future.
This is so sad, too. The Fulcrum had just gotten rid of their guardians. They're living in bliss. They're all having time.
Oh.
And then she ices them all.
Yeah.
Painful.
That was so stressful. That, like, interview.
Yeah, truly. It just, you knew something bad was going to happen. You could just, it had that vibe, but then it goes real bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we also find out the other guardians of Found Moon have completely lost themselves, so they're absolutely unhinged at this point. And ultimately, there's a couple other things that happen at the actual Found Moon, but ultimately, Jija has had enough, and he goes to rescue Nasoon because he hears a bunch of screaming and stuff coming from Found Moon, which, fair enough.
Yeah. fair enough.
Yeah. But yeah, he gets turned into stone too. Nathan makes her decision. Yep. She ultimately has to choose between like Shafa and her dad. And her dad's been kind of a dick lately, so she chooses Shafa.
Well, she's basically like, I get it. You're never going to love me. So guess what? You're dead.
Which I don't blame her one bit. Jijo is acting like a real nincompoop. So,
yeah, he's a dick for sure.
Yeah, he warned her. I thought that was a really cool scene like before this where they're visiting at his house and she just ices his entire house, but like keeps him unharmed, just like show how much she can like harness that power.
Yeah.
So he did give her like some warning signs, but yeah, I was fine with her killing the dad, but I also was nervous. Cause it's like, what kind of path will this lead her on, or will this like give her closure finally?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's going to give her closure.
Definitely. I don't think so.
If I had to guess, closure. It's not that one.
You know, usually in fiction, at least when you murder somebody, it doesn't usually give you closure, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, now she's up to like 24 murders, so. Yeah.
Old hat.
Yikes.
Asian still probably killed more. Shaf's definitely killed more.
They all have a pretty high body count at this point, and it's going to get higher as the season continues.
Yeah.
All right, let's choose our own adventure. How's that sound, boys?
Da, 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 da. Let's
do it. There we go. We don't even need to find the music. Chris is on it.
Yeah.
I'll clip that. We'll just use that every time.
Yeah. Da, 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 da. It'll be good.
Zach, was there any lore or history that you wanted to go over in this? I think we've talked through a bit of this, but...
Nope. I think we talked about most of it, and I think a lot of it is still kind of like a mystery for now or up for interpretation anyways.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Don't spoil anything then.
There's boil bugs on here. I'll just reiterate, the boil bugs are really cool. I liked a lot what the authors did with the boil bugs here. And just a good example of giving us a part of a magic system, making the rules specific, and then you introduce a new element to it, but you pull together the established magic system in an interesting and innovative way. And I think it works really well with the boil bugs.
Yeah, I was surprised it keeps coming back and is just showing like it's like a thermometer of how bad the season is getting is directly correlated to like how many boil bugs there are.
Yeah, so,
yeah.
It's going to be the season of the boil bugs.
Oh, maybe, actually. Do they have a name for the season yet, or is that like decided like after the fact?
It's got to be decided after.
Yeah, it has to be. Okay. Yeah.
All right, well, so we only had three POVs, basically two. I mean, Shafa barely counts as a POV.
Yeah.
Did you guys have a particular favorite? Did you like that they brought Nasoon into this as a POV, or what were your favorites?
Yeah, I go Nasoon over Asoon in this one for sure. But if you're just talking about like how effective the chapters were, I liked the Shafa. Like the Shafa hit 100%. You know, like the two Shafa chapters, I both liked so much. You know, you almost gotta give them 100% for just consistency there.
Shafa plays for 5 minutes, shoots 7 times, makes 6 of them, gets out of there with 20 points. You're like, holy cow, what is that? What just happened?
Give him more minutes, coach. Give him more minutes. Let's see.
Yeah, the start of Linsanity or something. All right, so this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, because they do describe the Stone Eaters in the first book a bit, but they don't really give us like a full description of them. So in your mind, when you're reading these books, and they bring up the Stone Eaters, how are you imagining those in your head?
They're all different for me. Definitely, like, I'm looking at a rock with the shape of a body, and the faces, I don't really imagine them too much. I don't get too detailed on the faces, so it's kind of hard to say. What about you, Zach?
Oh, man, this is going to be kind of embarrassing. I think...
Oh, I can't wait.
All of like the other Stone Eaters, I'll picture them as stone, or picture them as like jade, or like different types of jewels, like humans, but kind of in that like sculpture, like marble. I'll picture that. But for some reason, for Hoa, I imagine him as like that little boy from The Grudge.
Oh my God, that's exactly what I have written down. Damn.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I don't know why. He's like that kid for The Grudge, but everyone else is like, looks like a marble statue, like come to life. And yeah, I don't get it.
When I'm reading this, I imagine him as, you guys seen Interstellar?
Yeah.
You know, like the computer, like AI guy from that, who's just like basically like a block that has like arms that come out a little bit.
Oh, really?
I imagine him as that, but made of stone or like that's marble hilarious. Or something. Yeah.
That's funny.
Either that or like one of the, like a guy from like Minecraft. I don't know. Like one of the blockheads from that.
Yeah. Well, I guess, on the next one, I don't know. Brandon, do you have any predictions? I don't know if I have any like big predictions really. I do kind of have a bit of a, like a small prediction. It's just that what Stone Eaters are just really powerful origins that can tap into the magic and do so much that they turn into Stone Eaters. Cause that's kind of my view of what has happened to Alabaster and why he turned into stone. He essentially used so much magic that he is turning into a Stone Eater. And now he can never use orogeny again. He essentially overdid it. And that's how you turn into a Stone Eater. I don't know if that's really a theory, I guess, but when you see at the end of the book that if there's a Stone Eater that looks like the same stone that Alabaster was turning into, it's a brand new Stone Eater. It makes it seem like, okay, well, definitely a new Stone Eater was born, and a new Stone Eater was born through Alabaster's body. So it's like, my question is that Stone Eater Alabaster, or some entirely new entity, or some recreation of an old Stone Eater? I'm not really sure, but I kind of feel like maybe that is Alabaster, and I hope so.
Interesting. So you think he still has like the same consciousness in, or like memories or anything like that, or do you think it's just like a new person altogether, basically?
That's I think it's more likely that that is Alabaster still in some way. Though I'm sure it'll be a different person also in lots of ways. But that's kind of my prediction. That's still kind of Alabaster there, but maybe not. I don't know. I'm open to a lot of things there.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense than mine. I was thinking the exact opposite of that. I was thinking that the Guardians are becoming the Stone Eaters, because they're connected to the Father Earth. That's why they can't let him like get past a certain point. They have to kill him so they don't come into certain Stone Eaters. But I don't think that makes as much sense as what you're saying. I think it would make more sense for the origins to turn into a Stone Eater than the other way around. So, yeah.
Well, I do have, and then my other prediction, sorry, I'll just do this quick.
Oh, go ahead.
Is that, I'm not free. And this is another kind of small one too, but Aesun is going to kill Shafa, and Maesun is going to throw a fit in some way. I don't know exactly what she'll do, whether that's kill her mother or kill somebody else or kill a bunch of people or something. But I feel like they're really setting it up for Aesun's going to kill Shafa, and Naesun, now in love with Shafa, is not going to be thrilled with that.
There's definitely going to be a penultimate, like, showdown between Naesun and Aesun. I don't know if they're gonna be on like the same side eventually, like they'll talk into it, but it doesn't look like it's going that direction. But I don't know, maybe Nasun's like, hey, I killed Jija, and then Essien's like, oh, awesome. That's great news.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Jija is gone now, so. What about, any predictions?
I didn't have like a ton. Like I said, it's like so unpredictable, it's hard to make predictions, but
yeah,
my like main one is that the moon is just like a giant obelisk, essentially, that was made by Father Earth, which is why he wants it back, because that's how he gets his power, is through the moon. And so he's like, his power is like dampened because there's no moon currently. That's, I think, sort of implied already, maybe. I don't know if it's exactly that, but and then either Nasun or Essien is going to, you know, connect with the moon and ultimately like do something cool. I don't know, fix the Earth.
Yeah,
make
some sort of moon connection. Yeah,
something like that. But other than that, I have no idea. I have no predictions for Shafa whatsoever. You could tell me that he turns into like a donkey at some point, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, adds up.
Yeah.
And then last question I had here. So we got like kind of four sides of the conflict. We have Father Earth. We have the Guardians. We have Essien trying to get the moon back, and then we have the divide between the Stone Eaters. Do you think, as what we know now, do you think that there's a side that they're most justified in trying to do what they're doing?
I say no, just because I really don't even feel confident explaining what side anybody's on at this point. And the author has done such a good job of making everybody so empathetic and like giving you their perspective. So I really don't have, I haven't really picked a side, I don't think.
It's definitely a toss up, but I want the kind of antagonistic Stone Eaters to win. I want them to take out all the origins and reclaim the Earth for themselves.
Nice.
I think they're the most justified. Like the humans came around and fucked everything up for them. They had a pretty good, or the origins came around and fucked everything up for them. They had a pretty good deal there for a bit, but
yeah.
Yeah. Are you guys okay with what Alabaster did? Like, do you think he's justified? Like creating like the worst season like ever.
I think he could have told somebody else about it. He could include someone else in on the plan in case he dies, because then he just opened a rift for no reason, basically. Like, thank God for Essien, otherwise that would have been for nothing.
Yeah. Because I mean, like, even if his plan, like whatever his plan was or is, even if all that works out, there's still gonna be like millions and millions of people like dead.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, that's like fucked up.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm okay with what he's done. Maybe primarily because no point of view characters in this book have questioned it in any serious way. Like, I haven't had to sit down and try to reckon with what he's done, because nobody really seems to give a shit. Every time it's brought up, they're like, yeah, whatever. Oh, did he? Yeah. Did he break the world? Whatever. Let's move on. So it's like, okay.
Do other people know about it, or is it just Essien? I thought it was just Essien that knew about it. And then
they were kind of spreading the word at the end, at the end of this book. They were kind of
I think at the end,
Alabaster did it.
Yeah, I think she's mentioned it to a couple people. Like, that's the guy who destroyed the world. Or when it's like, why do you need him? It's like, well, he's the one that destroyed the world, and he's the only one that can, I don't know, not fix it, but. I don't know. It's tough.
Go ahead.
No, so like I understand. I guess I kind of understand why he did it. Like, book one kind of shows what happens to like all of his kids and the struggles that his kind faces everywhere they go. They'll always be like hunted, and there's like no freedom. So I do get his like motivation, and he's already kind of crazy. So how he'd be driven to that point of just like murdering a lot of people, but it is kind of like crazy to put it on paper of like, there's a good chance that the whole world just ends, like humankind ends. And if only like a couple thousand, like you're basically resetting everything, like in his mind. Like if things go the way that he wants it to go, you're basically just like starting over from like complete scratch. And it's just kind of it's crazy to hit like a hard reset, like a button.
Pretty rash for sure.
Yeah.
Also, I don't feel like he thought about the consequences of just like bringing a gravitational force back into orbit all of a sudden. Like, I feel like that would have a lot of adverse effects on the Earth. We just like all of a sudden the moon's back. It's like, I think that might or you like miscalculate and you like run the moon right into the earth. That's not good.
Right.
So I don't know. It seemed like a half cocked plan that he just kind of went forward with. And then it's killing millions of people at best. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Crazy Alabaster and his silly plans.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he'll learn now that he's a stone eater.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe. Well, any other, it's foregone conclusion now. I saw Zach's face during it. He was slightly nodding, I think. All right. Any other last thoughts? Are you guys ready to wrap up?
All set.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. As always, we love you. And we are the Knights of the Hardcover. Chris, hit the trumpet.
Burr, 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 burr.
Nailed it.